Welcome to Future Thinkers Podcast, episode 61. This is the second part of our conversation with medical anthropologist and ayahuasca shaman Don Roberto. For show notes for this episode, as well as the first half of this conversation, go to futurethinkers.org/60. Enjoy!
This episode is brought to you by Qualia, a premium nootropic supplement that helps support mental performance and brain health. It's specifically designed to promote focus, support energy, mental clarity, mood, memory, and creativity. Yuvi and I have both used it in the past. We really like it, and we actually met the founders and interviewed them on Future Thinkers. And you can check out those interviews. They're one of our favorites at futurethinkers.org/Daniel and futurethinkers.org/Jordan. They've got a new formula up called Qualia Mind. It's got more natural ingredients, and you can get it at futurethinkers.org/brainhack, and you can get 10% off if you use the code FUTURE.
All right, let's get into the show.
Welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvi Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you'd like a list of our top episodes and resources, go to futurethinkers.org/start.
And if you like our podcast, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes and elsewhere. It really helps others find the show, and we really appreciate it.
So let's continue on that thread, actually, of what it's like to be a Westerner entering into the shamanic tradition and going through the training that you did.
I think the key is an open mind. It's just to be able to say, I'm willing to experience what experience, and then make a sense of it thereafter. So gathering data and making hypotheses thereafter, rather than coming in with a straight list, this is how it's going to be, and trying to squeeze all the... one of my inspirations was a guy called Lyle Watson. Do you know about this guy? Okay, well, he wrote a book in the 70s called Supernature. And Lyle Watson was a South African, and his grandma used to just drop him off at this hut for the whole summer. We have enough food, and just go amuse yourself. And so, you know, he just spent a lot of time in deep nature. He was a white English South African, but he bonded with the Zulu people of the land. He watched their realities, and he could see things happening that were magical, that had no counterpart in the Anglo-civilized tradition. But, you know, he saw that it was valid, and then he grew up and he became a zoologist. And so he bore these two different traditions and knew that they were both equally valid. And his whole life was about, he became a director of the London Zoo, basically, or a part of it. And his whole life was about trying to synthesize his experiences and his knowledge. And the book Supernature was a cataloging using authentic research, scientific research, to create a picture. It was like saying, this is what's happening in nature. Isn't it fantastic? Look at the deeper patterns that are emerging, like the quantum entanglement between animals or mothers and sons. And then you read this, and it builds up into an argument of like, oh my goodness, the world is really infinitely more, much more mysterious than is presented in the ordinary journals. It's the small facts you pick up when you're at school. If you start seeing the deeper patterns, there is magicality to that. And so he was a very big inspiration to me. And the ability to hold two different realities and respect them, because he'd seen them working for themselves in different ways. So I'm a bit like that. You know, does it work? Faith is not good enough for me. I do want to experience it. When I was doing my field work in Kilimanjaro, my driver would always stop for the nuns. Always. Oh, there's a nun. Let's give her a lift. And then we have to spend 15 minutes while she does the prayer to protect the vehicle. And after a while, I said, no more nuns. We're really done with the nuns here. Because, look, let's face it, you know, Jesus saves, but your eyes are much more important in terms of driving, right? Because, you know, that's physics and, you know. So no more nuns. So it's physics that sustains an airplane, not prayer. You know, I'm quite clear about which domain works. But at certain times, there are certain ways of knowing and being and operating the consciousness that are much more effective than straight-ahead logic and linearity. Does that make sense?
Tell us about your training with the ayahuasca shamans. How did that come about?
I was really not looking for this path. Yes, there were like, you know, there were signs. I mean, so I finished my degree in Chinese and Spanish and linguistics, and then when I graduated, I thought the world was my oyster, because back in the day, when I studied my degree, there was 8 of us studying Chinese. Like, it was really early days, and, you know, now everybody and their uncle wants to study Chinese, but it was very few of us. So I thought to myself, I can get any job, you know, they're going to be clamoring. But there was a recession. I couldn't even get a job in a shop. It was that bad. And so I had to fall on my own resources. And so with a partner, I created a company called Stress Busters. If you've ever been to an airport and you've seen those foldable chairs that people sit in, we were the first people to do that in the UK. And so we got a lot of kind of coverage with the media and Sunday Times and BBC TV and all that. And so that kind of developed. Now, what was interesting is that I felt at the time I'd done enough academic work and enough cognitive work, and I wanted to do something with my hands. So that was a natural kind of outlet for that. And while I was learning all that and teaching that, I also was doing a lot of work in terms of body work, learning every weekend, doing training courses, just the hunger to learn, because the more I worked with the body, the more it revealed itself. So eventually, amongst my community of body workers, some people start saying, oh, there's this thing called body harmony. And I said, well, what is it? We can't explain. You just have to experience it. So I kept hearing this thing. And then finally, I was doing a show in Bristol, and there was a practitioner. So I signed up for a session with her. So I'm there. I'm clothed on her table, and she comes, approaches the table, and then she just goes, your body doesn't like metal. And I'm like, what the fuck? She goes, no, your body doesn't like metal. And I'm like, I look at her astonished because it's absolutely true. I'm like, how do you know? She goes, I know because in the same time I'm working with you, or my focus is on you, my attention's on you, my focus is on how my body responds to your body. And so as I approach to you, my watch starts to hurt me, which is your body telling me, get the fuck out of here. Don't come near me with that watch, with that metal. And I just went, oh, that's a whole different way of working and a whole different level. And so that was my first introduction to body harmony. So the next year, I signed up with the Don McFarlane in Glastonbury to train with him. I did a 10-day training. And so basically what it is there's no protocols. Because normally in body work, like, oh, you've got this problem, boom, we're going to go in and work this and then do that. And there's a whole kind of sequence of things you're going to do. You know, we know what to do. The whole idea behind body harmony was every single body wants to tell its stories. But are you able to listen? Are you worthy to hear those deeper stories? Because if you're like a deep tissue worker, you're going to go, blah, and you're going to rush in and do the work, and you're not going to listen. So the whole our training was about learning to listen. So in terms of approaching the body, you know, I can just go into your shoulder, but then I've cut across all these layers. At a deep level, the body goes, you didn't listen to me, fuck you. I'm not going to open up, right? But if you actually start here, there's an energy layer, right, like maybe 4 feet or even 6 feet. And then, you know, I can feel it, even withdrawing here. But then if I ask permission to you, your body, and it'll say, okay. And then I've got permission to move forward. And then it'll actually slowly guide me in. It'll pull me in like a flight path. This is the way to approach my body. So by the time, it might take 5 minutes or 10 minutes of constantly asking for permission, 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 permission. And then by the time, you know, you make physical contact with the first layer of skin, there's such a deep connection, such a deep kind of rapport with the body that it's actually going to, it knows that you have respect and you can listen, and it'll pull you in deeper. And so what then happens, it's not really physical, it's about consciousness meeting consciousness. And it's about, if I eventually meet your shoulder, my consciousness then has permission to travel within your body. So maybe let's say there's an issue in your hip, in your left hip, in the inside of your hip socket. I can, with consciousness, travel down and work inside your body. As long as I, every stage, again, ask permission. And so, you know, by day four of doing this, I went, holy Moses, this isn't about body work. This is about being in the right place at the right time and asking permission and checking in. Because, I mean, eventually the body opens up to such an extent it starts talking to you. Oh, to me. So they're like, you know, like the kidneys will say, help, we're a bit, you know, we need more water. Like, ugh. And I'm walking down the street and like all these parts are talking to me, like, too, because I'm so hypersensitive to it. So this brought up this whole new way of knowing. So for example, while I was training, I was with my girlfriend and I woke up and our knees were touching, her knee against my knee. And there was this flow of information between the knees. I was like, our knees are having a conversation, but without us. Like, each body part is alive. It has an opinion, it has awareness, like you're saying, everything's aware. So our knees were having this like this. I could feel this flow, like, and I woke her up and said, I said, Nicola, I said, our knees are having a conversation. Oh, okay. But I was like, wow, that's amazing. So this opened up this whole level. Remember, David also opened up the, you know, the mythopoetic, but this whole level of concrete physicality and this awareness that there is also lots of emotions and memories contained within body part, the various parts of the body, was amazing. And the listening also brought up a whole level of knowing. So, for example, I was giving a session in Ibiza with a quite a matronly 50-year-old woman, very conservatively dressed and all that, and I was off her body tuning in, listening, and then I just was around her tummy and I went, there are like two alien presences in her tummy that shouldn't be there. I was astonished. She had her eyes closed, and suddenly those eyes opened, and she goes, without any previous communication, she goes, yes, I've had two abortions. I'm like, wow, because I could feel that. I could feel the energetic imprint. So it really, that the body harmony and the bodywork training really enhanced my sensory capacity. We all have it. It's just a question of really becoming familiar with it. That really then comes into the shamanic work, because, again, it's about listening. And one final story about this, how it's connected, is that a couple of years later, I was hanging out at a friend's house in London, and this lady was quite astonishing. She spoke fluent Russian. She was a Russian language graduate, and she'd done work for Greenpeace, actually monitoring the nuclear emanations from reactors. And then somehow she found herself in Kamchatka, right in the far, far east of Russia. And so on her bedroom table was this tusk, this ivory tusk, and it was carved with these scenes of Inuit or Eskimo hunting. I looked at it and I thought, wow, I really want to touch this. And so, but, you know, having learned, I thought, I'm going to ask permission. Can I touch you? Directly to the spirit or whatever is in this awareness, in this tusk. And it just goes, no. Well, all right, I've got to respect it. I turn around and I continue talking to her. And then, like, 20 minutes later, I get this, like, tap on the shoulder. I'm like, oh, all right, okay. And I turn around and it goes, ah, I guess you listened and you asked permission. You can now touch me. So I reach out and I touch this walrus. Oh, no, I touch this ivory tusk. It was about 3 inches. And then, boom, this whole energy went straight into me, jumped into me. And I'm like, I could feel this energy body descending. Like, suddenly I have this new energy body. And I'm like, okay, so what's happening here? And I begin to palpate the energy body around me, the aura. And I find that there's this kind of a snout and some whiskers. And here's a tusk. Okay. And here's another tusk. Hang on. It's kind of broken and shardy. And like, okay. So then, in the true tradition of empirical, I said to my friend, can you come here and check something out for me? You know, am I really crazy? And so I said, can you just feel my aura, just feel this energy? And she goes, oh, wow, I can feel like, you know, this snouty thing and whiskers and a tusk and another. Oh, hang on a minute, it's broken here. I thought to myself, okay, good, we're both crazy. So we're dealing with that. And then suddenly I'm like, okay, I need to go into the other room now. And so then we went into the other room, and then the room became really cold, just like this Arctic cold descended into the room. I was suddenly bilocating, and I could see, I said, okay, so everything's gray, and here's the kind of shingly beach, and it reaches into the gray water, which merges with the gray sky, and there's a spit of land that is also gray in a lighthouse. And she goes, oh my God, that's exactly where I was this summer. And it looks exactly like that. And that's exactly where I found the carved ivory. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then, you know what, Eleanor? I said to her, I just have this incredible desire to lie on the floor on the side and then flap my arm for a bit. Would you mind if I just did that? She goes, no, be my guest. Right. So then I was like doing that for about 10 minutes. I'm like, oh, this feels really good, but, you know, please don't take any photographs of this. And then I got up and then I actually moved around the room. And as I moved, I could feel that the seawater was coming out to my eyes, depending where I was, because suddenly it was a sudden dip. And I was like, oh, and then I moved back. And I was like, so I was astonished. I was like, well, what was that about? And then I rode the subway back home. And then this presence just said, where am I? I said, well, this is like, what is it, 1995 or something like that. And I said, it's 1995, and you're in a place called London. And he was looking around at this crush of people in the train, like, do you live like this? I said, yes, we do. And I said, okay, so who, what's your name? And he goes, my name is Jehula. I was like, well, where'd that come from? I said, okay, Jehula. So that presence was with me for a couple of weeks until it then gradually dissipated. So that was really strong. And then I Googled this name, and the only reference to Jehula is an abandoned, destroyed village in Israel in 1947. So there's no way that I could have, you know, researched that or found that. So what I'm saying here is that the pathway to shamanism was a slow thing, and it was actually connected to experiences that opened my eyes to realities that were beyond what I was being taught, and then direct experiences. So the body work is as direct as you can get. So, you know, sometimes I'd be working with somebody and I just have this rush, like, you know, and I know my emotional state is steady and I just go have tears coming to my eyes or rage. And I'm like, okay, so I can distinguish them. So these realities are true. So from there on, it kind of dissipated until I did various things, like worked in the City of London with finance and stuff like that, very boring muggle stuff, and then decided, hey, I'm done with London. It's just, I'm running so hard to stay in the same place. It's useless and it's not working for me. The system's not working for me. So I decided to move back to Taiwan, where I did my year abroad. And then after a few years, I went, you know what? I need to go back into cognitive mode. I need to stimulate the brain cells. And so I decided to do medical anthropology, because I always was, since the days when I was a kid looking at National Geographic, I thought healing, anthropology, medical anthropology. And then I did that. And then I came back. And I was living a nice little life doing photography and stuff like that. And then suddenly, you know, I got a knock on the door and it was somebody else inviting me to experience ayahuasca in Taiwan. All places.
So what was that like for the first time?
Well, the thing is, back in the days in 2007, you know, Facebook was rolling out, you know, a social network. If you were interested in lineup dancing with dwarves, you could find some freak who was also interested in lineup dancing with dwarves. You know, intra-specific in your cities. They've stopped all that now. But, I mean, that's probably how they found me, because then I looked at their interests. They were living in a city 40 minutes from me, and male and South African, and then interest shamanism and ayahuasca. Now, think about ayahuasca. 20 years previously, I'd read a book called The Way of the Shaman by Michael Hana. I don't know if you've heard of it, or maybe your listeners have. In the 50s, Michael Hana was, well, he was an anthropologist, and he basically spent time with the Shipibo Kanibo in Peru, and they were very loath to give him the ayahuasca. They just thought he was a puny white person who couldn't handle it. Eventually, he convinces them to take it, for them to give it to him. And then he has these extraordinary experiences, very layered and very specific. And in the morning, the shaman comes to him and says, well, you know, first you went here, and then you saw this, and then you had this conversation, but don't worry about them. They're always saying that. They're always boasting. And the thing is, it was on point. Every single thing that he experienced, he was being related back to him. And the thing that stuck with me was that this shaman was blind. So I'm reading this going, you know, 1987, going, okay, so there's got to be some kind of objective reality here. But Peru, very interesting, but Peru's too far, too expensive, too many mosquitoes, blah, blah, blah. I'm really not into chasing drug experiences. And I kind of kept it in my head. So 20 years, fast forward 20 years, 2007, I'm in Taiwan. And this guy's knocking on my door saying ayahuasca. And I'm like, okay, what's the story here? We're in Taiwan, not Peru. Ah, oh, but we have similar plants that can do the same thing. What? And so that same week, I met another guy from a similar city. And it's a straight up business PhD guy, really normal conversation. But when he finished the conversation, lunch, he said, I have something for you. And so he reached down under the table, he pulled out this jar of brown liquid. And I looked at it and went, I don't drink coffee. Oh, no, it's not coffee. I said, well, what is it? You guessed it. Ayahuasca. I said, no way. No way. Twice in the same week. Right? It's not been on my right radar. And suddenly, boom. And then I said, do you know this person? Never heard of him. I said, oh, hello. Part of shamanism is reading the signs, right? So there's the universe talking to me. So then the first guy, he contacts me and goes, hey, we're going to do a ceremony in 6 weeks. Do you want to come? Fuck yes. Of course, you know, I'm being called. Hello. I'd be stupid not to see this. So I did all the preparations and the day arrives, because it was a daytime thing. And the day arrives and I have the biggest flu possible. I'm thinking, are you kidding me? So anyway, I dragged myself down there. And it was the daytime thing, strangely enough. And they kind of gathered around a few people. They warmed the medicine up and said, well, thank you very much indeed. And then we drank it and then sat there, like in the kitchen. And then, you know, 30 minutes later, my stomach is really saying, this is, what were you thinking? I rush out into the garden. And I purge in the flower bed. And then I turn around and I look at this guy, and he's smiling at me. He's smiling at me, but his head's on fire. Right? Like, you know, in the visions, his head is completely on fire and he has this like Tibetan demon look. I'm like, shit, this is really strong. It's never happened. I've done LSD and magic mushrooms, but I've never had something, a daylight vision like that. I'm like looking at him going, okay. And then actually then the energy hit me. And it's actually quite different to how you guys experience it or how I've experienced it since. It was really like I couldn't stand. I was just convulsing like this. I was like, okay. And luckily, they put tents in the garden, so I could disgrace myself in, you know, quietly in the tent. So I opened the tent flap, plonked myself down, took my glasses off, closed my eyes, and then the vision started. It wasn't just visions, because normally the visions are in front of you. This was IMAX right behind my head. I was looking behind my head going, are you kidding me? You know, surround visions, and they were changing geometric figures and stuff like that. And then they died away, and I was left in silence. And still convulsing like this, but I just thought, you know, this is, okay, this is what's going to be. And then I felt that presence, that intelligence that was just of a magnitude that I couldn't even fathom. That's when I had that realization. I just went, hang on a minute. And then it scanned me, like, you know, like a little laser up and down, like, who are you, carbon unit? Okay, and I was like, oh, just me. And then I had that realization. I went, oh, my God, I didn't just drink a liquid. I didn't drink a chemical or a drug. I actually took in a living presence. Whether it's a spirit or not, it doesn't matter, a living presence, because I could feel it resident in my body. And then it said, let me show you what happens when you die, after you die. And I'm like, okay. And then, boom. Just my consciousness was then free of form. And a consciousness free of form is infinite. And then my consciousness was as wide as the widest sky. So the first thing I said to myself was like, oh, this is really serious. Second thing, the Tibetans really know what they're talking about. And third thing is like, I think I've found what I've been looking for all my life. This is the apogee of my searching, and, you know, that brought me to this moment. Because at that point in time, when I was like, what am I doing? I have a master's, I'm teaching kids who don't really care, and why am I here? And I had to be here to be in the right place at the right time. And so presence, spirit, the medicine, whatever it is, actually took me on a guided tour of the entire universe. And then I came out of that experience going, I think I found what I'm looking for, and that's where we have to start. What I thought I knew, let's just throw that away, because compared to what I've just experienced, yeah, we don't know anything. So that's how I started. Wow. And everything else was progressive and organic. You know, there were various milestones and steps, but basically, you know, what I do today is I try and bring that teaching and make it accessible, you know. So it's accessible in terms of cost, because some of these now, these people are charging huge amounts of money, and it's not about that. It's about the work, because I've been gifted with this information, knowledge, and, you know, once you know, you can't unknow, and to know is to serve. You know, what am I going to do with this unless I transmit it and pay it forward?
And this was 10 years ago.
Yeah, 2008.
I'm sure a lot of people are listening to this and thinking either this guy's nuts, or if he's not nuts and there's something to this, then, I want to try it, and holy shit, this is going to change the world. So if everybody did.
No, I'm not concerned about changing the world. I think it starts with the individual. Just do your own work and then pay it forward, and then small things can grow from that. And it's too grandiose. I want to change the world. No. Just tidy up your room.
Channeling Jordan Peterson
here. Yeah, clean up your room. Stand up straight.
Stand up straight. Tidy your room up.
Yeah. There's this psychologist who is a Jungian, is a Canadian psychologist who's become very popular, especially with the young men in the last couple of years. And he's very, like, kind of this father figure. We interviewed him on the show, actually.
Did?
Yeah, and he talks about that, you know, just sort yourself out first. Stop, you know.
Stop with these ambitions of changing the world, yeah. You 18-year-old stupid idiot. You know nothing. Go fix yourself first.
Yeah.
But is he being condescending, or is he compassionate?
No, he's very hard, but he's right. And a lot of young men are really seeing that and being like, oh, I have to change this. You know, I have to change my life. He wrote this book called 12 Rules for Life. It was fantastic.
But do you not think that's a failure of, you know, our society in general regarding the masculine and a lack of initiation?
Yes. I think that's exactly what it is.
It's a lack of mentorship. And it's also the hyper-feminization and the kind of taking away of how men naturally are and want to be. So I think that's...
Yeah, like this no-tolerance bullying policies in schools, yeah, or safe football. Spaces. Yeah.
Yeah, or even that's too violent. Like, they can't be physical with each other anymore.
Can I share something very risque?
Yeah.
Okay, I look at contemporary soccer and I go, what is wrong with you people? He just tapped you and you're like rolling around like you've been murdered.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a rugby player, old rugby player. They're like, you know, people would pile on top of you, just shake yourself down and go, that was fun. Let's get on.
Yeah, exactly. Take a hit.
Come on, guys. You know.
We both did martial arts when we were younger. And it's like, yeah, when you get like, when somebody kicks you in the head, you're like, oh, that was a good job. My head's going to be ringing for like 5 minutes now. But yeah, that was good. That's a good one.
Yeah, now they get the lawsuits and the moms.
Okay, so there's that. It's a bit silly in certain ways. But yeah, essentially, just begin with yourself.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Yeah, so the way this work has grown has been organically. People contact me and say, would you be willing to come here? And I do travel. And it's through organic connections. And then people say, would you work with my community? I said, fine, we got to get a certain number, a certain kind of venue, and we can arrange that and we can talk about schedules. And that's how it grows. I'll go where I must and invited, basically. Yeah.
Where are you going to be next?
Actually, next, it's funny you mentioned dreams and precognitive dreams, because 10 years ago, I had a dream that I was walking around somewhere in the Caucasus, in a city in the Caucasus, either Georgia or Armenia. And the time has arrived where I thought, you know, next week I'm going to Georgia to see if this is where I have to be, or maybe next year to Armenia, because something's waiting for me. You know, that kind of precognitive dream. Why did I have that very vivid dream or very big dream? Because something has to happen there. It's maybe transmission or a connection. So I'm going to Georgia for a holiday for a week, to Tbilisi. Not Georgia, America, Tbilisi, the city. And then to Bosnia to see the pyramids. And then on to the cool. Middle East.
Are you back to States and Canada or anywhere in the North America?
Hopefully next year I'll be doing a Canadian tour across all the cities for the first time. So I'm looking forward to eating some, what is it, poutine?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And some British Columbia product. The finest of the British Columbia, whatever that might be. And yeah, so things are expanding in a very organic way. And what we see, but it's not just, I'm not going to just parachute in. I want to build communities and serve those communities regularly so that we can all develop. I was in South Africa, and one of the most beautiful things I heard in sharing was this guy said, I've come to the realization that all we're doing is we're all walking each other home. And actually, that brought tears to my eyes because, you know, I'm no better than anyone else. I have different experiences and different skills, but we're all here on planet Earth. We're all faced to the same kind of challenges at the end of the day. And, you know, you in doing your podcast, you're helping those listeners and transmitting information, and I do what I do. And, you know, we're here now, working with each other.
So if someone wants to experience the ceremony for themselves, what do they have to do?
There are a lot of ceremonies that are happening around the world. It's possible to find a circle if you look hard enough. The caveat I would have is that some people think that just because it's easy to make a brew, because it's, you know, putting certain things together, that it qualifies them to run a ceremony or to hold space for a ceremony. It's the equivalent of saying, hey, I flew a budget airline, I can commandeer a 747 or a 767. You know, I can drive that. I can fly that. No, they're very different. Being a passenger is not the same as being a pilot. And there are many, many things that can happen in ceremony space. There's many levels of consciousness. Some people, there's a releasing of trauma that needs to be held properly. If they're not held in space properly, they can in itself be a traumatic experience. Catharsis can be very challenging. There can be a lot of physicality. At times, even within a well-held space, if somebody came in from the outside, it might look like bedlam. And they will call psychiatric services and everybody get locked up. So, you know, there's an ability to sit in that flow of dynamic processes that is a requisite for somebody who's going to hold and to keep calm and to keep balanced and to navigate that. And if that's not held well, it can be traumatic for the whole group. And
just watching it, just being there the first night, it was like a jungle swamp. That's what it sounded
kind
like
of.
To me. Like,
there's a flow. There's definitely a flow.
Yeah, yeah. Just listening to all the sounds and the there's a lot of people purging. There's a lot of wet sounds. There's a lot of like kind of moaning and crying and struggling, and like it was just,
you're not
just
selling
wow.
It, dude.
Yeah, I know. Still a fantastic. I was the whole time through that. I was grinning because it was such an amazing experience. But it's just, you're right. If someone came in and saw that, it'd be like bedlam.
This is the thing. The training exists for a reason. It's there. It's not just, oh, I've concocted a brew and let's go. Or I've got some Caro playlist lined up on YouTube. Let's hit the ayahuasca and see what emerges. Or I can play guitar. That makes me a shaman. No. I mean, there are all these kind of levels of perception and hubris exist. I mentioned earlier that shamanism isn't about the shaman. Shamanism is about partnership, and it's about partnership with those guiding spirits in other realms. And within the Amazonian tradition, how do you get to have those partnerships with the plants? It's a process called dieta, plant dieta. And what a plant dieta is strict observance of dietary requirements and sexual requirements, and also social requirements and media. So no salt, no sugar, no spices, no fried foods. The blindness of the blind, no sexual activity for a defined period, and often isolation, and often, you know, withdrawal from books and media and stuff like that. So when you open a dieta, or when the shaman opens a dieta for you, it's basically you're creating a covenant between you and a plant. Let's say it's Rose. You want to receive the teachings and guidance and wisdom and technology of what Rose has. So you have nothing substantial to give it. You can't give it money. You can't do Bitcoin to Rose. But what you do have is your sacrifice, to show that you're worthy to receive, you know, the recipient of his teachings. And so this is the sacrifice you make from the sensory pleasures, from the desire for taste, desire for sexual contact, etc., or even connection with other people. You're thrown back on your own being. And what happens is there is an energetic connection that is forged between you and this plant from wherever it comes from. And it lands in your root chakra, in your sexual power. This is why the injunction against sex is very important, because your sexual reproductive power is also your healing power. And that's where it roots itself. And then it starts to grow as a plant would grow energetically within your body. So we're creating this kind of symbiosis, that this hybrid human plant, you know, relationship. And let's say then when you finish, like, oh, 2 weeks or a month or 3 months, and some of them are even a year long, and that's a long time of sacrifice, then you have that deep connection with that plant. So that when this person is in ceremony and they sing, they don't just sing by themselves, they sing accompanied by the vibration of that plant, the rose vibration. And that vibration is actually the medicine. The highest frequency of that plant isn't resident in the leaves or the roots. It's actually its energetic imprint. So when I'm singing, yes, my voice, but my voice is a carrier wave for all the other plants that are resident within me because I've done the dieta. So that's the actual healing from those plants, and they can do several things at the same time, impacting your body through song, together with the tobacco, together with the ayahuasca. And that's that whole process of training and discipline is what defines somebody who's qualified to hold the space, because they obviously have, you know, I can't think of any doctors. Yes, their whole training, Western doctors, is arduous, but they don't have to go through that level of sacrifice, which is like, no, the bland food for 3 months, no sexual activity. I mean, this is a very demanding thing. If you're going to be with a shamanic practitioner, ask them what their training has. Have they done dieta? Very important. Do they have a lineage? Are they connected with an energetic lineage that supports them in the work? And what work have they done themselves? Because this isn't just the top down, I'm going to do this to you. Have they done the work themselves? So when I go to the jungle, the dieta brings up shit, peels the onion further and further and further, reaches deep. Last time I was in the jungle, the plants were saying, we're dealing with stuff you don't even know you have. It's so deep in your operating system, you're blind to it. So let's work it. And they just pull it out. And it's like, where do you start? How do you leverage that if you don't even know you have it? So that's the function. So my belief is that a shaman can only take you as far as they've gone themselves. If they've not done the work themselves, if they haven't gone up and they haven't gone down, deep, 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 they can't lead you. And that's why when I've met very powerful shamans, I kiss their hand in gratitude, because I know they've done the work. You can just see it. You can just see the power they have. So that's my advice, you know, because there are many charlatans out there that are doing it for the wrong reasons. They're doing it for ego. They're doing it for financial gain. I don't know what, you know, they're doing it because they have the God complex, because some people experience ayahuasca and it's such a powerful cosmic energy that they identify with it and think they're the root of it. And this is how the cults start. There's some things that have gone on with ayahuasca that's been abusive and it's not right, you know. So to keep yourself in check, does a person have discipline as well? That's another thing.
There's lots of other stuff that is fascinating. The information that people receive on during their journeys, how it just pops out of nowhere, seemingly.
Yes, But it's resident either in the space or within them or as a group. Sometimes that energy emerges. I'll tell you a quick anecdote. I'm in the jungle and suddenly this window appears and I'm actually looking at an alien civilization. Like, and I'm kind of feeling into it rather than kind of talking to these people. I'm actually observing it like an alien family or whatever. And then I had this realization. I went, they are on such a level that, you know, like science fiction movies, there's usually like they come to Earth and they're looking for to steal our women or steal our gold or our water or our resources and just real mundane stuff. These beings are on such a different level that we're like amoeba to them. It's like, that really struck me. I was like, oh my God, we think we're really it. But, you know, there are civilizations out there that are just infinitely more complicated and advanced. A parting thing I'd like to share with you. Sometimes we get these messages. So how do we know it's me? How do you know it's not you generating it? You know, like you get this insight, you go, well, how do I know this is my brain working or my imagination? For me personally, when it shocks me by how amazing it is or how unusual it is, because I'm actually not very imaginative. I don't surprise myself, right, with my imagination. I go, oh, never imagined that before. It's kind of it's quite pedestrian and quite limited. But sometimes these dialogues emerge. And then, so for example, one day in the jungle, training, ayahuasca spirit comes to me and goes, oh, you humans, it's all about love. Love, 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 love. I'm like, it isn't. No, it's not about love. I said, well, what is it about then? It's about forgiveness. What? It's about forgiveness. Well, what do you mean? Look, you can only love to the extent you can forgive. It's inverse. I'm like, can you hear that? That was the sound of my jaw dropping. He was like, oh my God, because it really resonated. I just suddenly went, oh, you're absolutely, and then it went on about, and the thing is, human beings hold resentment at so many, many, many levels. They resent themselves, they resent their parents, they resent society, they resent God, they resent the universe, and these are all invisible poisons. So we need to take those out because they're obstacles to forgiveness. Let's begin, shall we? I mean, he actually physically said, here, here, here. I'm like, oh my God, you're right. You know, but the thing about resenting God, I was like, wow, yeah, that's really powerful, you know, on a very, very secret, deep, you know, soul level. Anyway. But other than that, I'm a normal person.
All this stuff aside.
No, it's like, if I'm on, right? I can do my stuff. And then when I'm off, I'm like, you know, what's on TV? You know, I don't know, let's go for a meal together and have a laugh, you know. So there's nothing special, really, you know. Actually, it's a disadvantage to be on all the time. You know, like you see the spirits moving through your space and, you know, getting downloads 24/7. It's such a pain in the ass. You know what I mean, right? It'd be so tiring. Like, if I have a friend that she had to be on antidepressants because she just couldn't handle it. She just had to numb herself from all of that. So I'm lucky. Anyway, a pleasure, guys. Thank you so much. Yeah. So hopefully the listeners will think the same way as well.
All right, that's it for the second part of our interview with Don Roberto. The show notes for both parts are available at futurethinkers.org/60.
If you're new to the show and you'd like a list of our top episodes and resources, go to futurethinkers.org/start. If you want to sponsor our show, go to futurethinkers.org/sponsor.
If you like our podcast, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes and elsewhere. It helps others find the show, and we really appreciate it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode. Bye!